Simon & Schuster Audio presents Blaze by Richard Bachman, with an introduction by Stephen King, read by Ron McLarty.
Full disclosure. Dear constant reader, this is a trunk novel, okay? I want you to know that while you've still got your sales slip and before you drip something like gravy or ice cream on it and thus make it difficult or impossible to return. In saying this, I assume you're like me and rarely sit down to a meal or even a lowly snack without your current book near at hand. It's a revised and updated trunk novel, but that doesn't change the basic fact. The Bachman name is on it because it's the last novel from 1966 through 1973, which was that gentleman's period of greatest productivity. During those years, I was actually two men. It was Stephen King who wrote and sold horror stories to raunchy skin mags like Cavalier and Adam. With this exception, Bachman, writing under the pseudonym of John Swithin, sold a single hard crime story, The Fifth Quarter. But it was Bachman who wrote a series of novels that didn't sell to anybody. These included Rage, now out of print and a good thing, The Long Walk, Roadwork, and The Running Man. The Bachman novel following these was thinner, and it was no wonder I got outed, since that one was actually written by Stephen King. The bogus author photo on the back flap fooled no one. All four were published as paperback originals. Blaze was the last of those early novels, The Fifth Quarter, if you like, or just another well-known writer's trunk novel, if you insist. It was written in late 1972 and early 1973. I thought it was great while I was writing it, and crap when I read it over. My recollection is that I never showed it to a single publisher, not even Doubleday, where I had made a friend named William G. Thompson. Bill was the guy who would later discover John Grisham. And it was Bill who contracted for the book following Blaze, a twisted but fairly entertaining tale of prom night in central Maine. I believe I am the only writer in the history of English storytelling whose career was based on sanitary napkins. That part of my literary legacy seems secure. I forgot about Blaze for a few years. Then, after the other early Bachmans had been published, I took it out and looked it over. After reading the first 20 pages or so, I decided my first judgment had been correct and returned it to Purda. I thought the writing was okay, but the story reminded me of something Oscar Wilde once said. He claimed it was impossible to read The Old Curiosity Shop without weeping copious tears of laughter. I have had the same reaction to Every Man by Philip Roth, Thomas Hardy's Jude the Obscure, and The Memory Keeper's Daughter by Kim Edwards. At some point while reading these books, I just start to laugh, wave my hands and shout, "Bring on the cancer, bring on the blindness, we haven't had those yet." So Blaze was forgotten, but never really lost. It was only stuffed in some corner of the Fogler Library at the University of Maine, with the rest of their Stephen King, Richard Bachman stuff. Blaze ended up spending the next 30 years in the dark. Not in an actual trunk, though, in a cardboard carton. And then I published a slim paperback original called The Colorado Kid with an imprint called Hard Case Crime. This line of books, the brainchild of a very smart and very cool fellow named Charles Ardai, was dedicated to reviving old noir and hard-boiled paperback crime novels and publishing new ones. The Kid was decidedly soft-boiled, but Charles decided to publish it anyway, with one of those great old paperback covers. A dame with trouble in her eyes and ecstasy, presumably in her pants. The whole project was a blast, except for the slow royalty payments. Also a throwback to the bad old paperback days, now that I think of it. About a year later, I thought maybe I'd like to go the hard case route again, possibly with something that had a harder edge. My thoughts turned to Blaze for the first time in years. But trailing along behind came that damn Oscar Wilde quote about the old curiosity shop. The Blaze I remembered wasn't hard-boiled noir, but a three-handkerchief weepy. Still, I decided it wouldn't hurt to look. If that was, the book could even be found. I remembered the carton, and I remembered the squarish typeface, my wife Tabitha's old college typewriter, an impossible-to-kill Olivetti portable. But I had no idea what had become of the manuscript that was supposedly inside the carton. For all I knew, it was gone, baby, gone. In my career, I have managed to lose not one, but two pretty good novels in progress. Under the Dome was only 50 pages long at the time it disappeared, but The Cannibals was over 200 pages at the time it went MIA. No copies of either. That was before computers, and I never used carbons for first drafts. It felt haughty somehow. It wasn't gone. Marcia, one of my two valuable assistants, found it in the Fogler Library. She would not trust me with the original manuscript. I lose things. But she made a Xerox. I must have been using a next-door-to-dead typewriter ribbon when I composed Blaze, because the copy was barely legible, and the notes in the margins were little more than blurs. Still, I sat down with it and began to read, ready to suffer the pangs of embarrassment only one's younger, smart-assier self can provide. But I thought it was pretty good. Certainly better than Roadwork, which I had at the time considered mainstream American fiction. It just wasn't a noir novel. It was rather a stab at this sort of naturalism with crime that James M. Cain and Horace McCoy practiced in the 30s. And of course it's an homage to Of Mice and Men. Kinda hard to miss that. I thought the flashbacks were actually better than the front story. They reminded me of James T. Farrell's Young Lonergan trilogy and the forgotten but tasty Gashouse McGinty. Sure, it was the three P's in places, purple, pulsing, and panting, but it had been written by a young man, I was 25, who was convinced he was writing for the ages. I thought Blaze could be rewritten and published without too much embarrassment, but it was probably wrong for hard case crime. It was, in a sense, not a crime novel at all. I thought it could be a minor tragedy of the underclass, if the rewriting was ruthless. To that end, I adopted the flat, dry tones which the best noir fiction seems to have, even using a type font called American Typewriter, to remind myself of what I was up to. I worked fast, never looking ahead or back, wanting also to capture the headlong drive of those books. I'm thinking more of Jim Thompson and Richard Stark here than I am of Cain, McCoy, or Farrell. I thought I would do my revisions at the end with a pencil, rather than editing in the computer, as is now fashionable. If the book was going to be a throwback, I wanted to play into that rather than shying away from it. I also determined to strip all the sentiment I could from the writing itself. Wanted the finished book to be as stark as an empty house without even a rug on the floor. My mother would have said, I wanted its bare face hanging out. Only the reader will be able to judge if I succeeded. If it matters to you, it shouldn't, hopefully you came for a good story and hopefully you'll get one, any royalties or subsidiary income generated by Blaze will go to the Haven Foundation, which was created to help freelance artists who are down on their luck. To learn more about the Haven Foundation, you can go to my website. That'd be www.stephenking.com. One other thing, I guess, while I've got you by the lapel. I tried to keep the Blaze time frame as vague as possible, so it wouldn't seem too dated. I didn't like the idea of Clay Blaisdell growing up in post-World War II America. All that has come to seem impossibly antique, although it seemed, and probably was, okay in 1973, when I was pecking it out in the trailer where my wife and I lived with our two children. It was impossible to take out all the dated material, however. Keeping some of it was important to the plot. If I had written it today, certainly cell phones and caller ID would have needed to be taken into consideration. If you think of this story's time frame as America, not all that long ago, I think you'll be okay. May I close by circling back to where I started? This is an old novel, but I believe I was wrong in my initial assessment that it was a bad novel. You may disagree. But the old curiosity shop, it ain't. As always, constant reader, I wish you well. I thank you for reading this story, and I hope you enjoy it. I won't say I hope you missed up a little, but, yeah, I will say that. Just as long as they're not tears of laughter. Stephen King, for Richard Bachman, Sarasota, Florida, January 30th, 2007. Chapter 1. George was somewhere in the dark. Blaze couldn't see him, but the voice came in loud and clear, rough and a little hoarse. George always sounded as if he had a cold. He'd had an accident when he was a kid. He never said what, but there was a dilly of a scar on his Adam's apple.
"Not that one, you dummy. It's got bumper stickers all over it. Get a Chevy or a Ford. Dark blue or green. 2 years old. No more, no less. Nobody remembers them. And no stickers."
Blaze passed the little car with the bumper stickers and kept walking. The faint thump of the bass reached him even here, at the far end of the beer joint's parking lot. It was Saturday night and the place was crowded. The air was bitterly cold. He had hitched him a ride into town, but now he had been in the open air for 40 minutes and his ears were numb. He had forgotten his hat. He always forgot something. He had started to take his hands out of his jacket pockets and put them over his ears, but George put the kibosh on that. George said his ears could freeze, but not his hands. You didn't need your ears to hotwire a car. It was 3 above 0.
"There," George said. "On your right."
Blaze looked and saw a Saab with a sticker. It didn't look like the right kind of car at all.
"That's your left," George said. "Your right, dummy. The hand you pick your nose with."
"I'm sorry, George." Yes, he was being a dummy again. He could pick his nose with either hand, but he knew his right, the hand you write with. He thought of that hand and looked to that side. There was a dark green Ford there. Blaze walked over to the Ford, elaborately casual. He looked over his shoulder. The beer joint was a college bar called The Bag. That was a stupid name. A bag was what you called your balls. It was a walk down. There was a band on Friday and Saturday nights. It would be crowded and warm inside. Lots of little girls in short skirts dancing up a storm. It would be nice to go inside, just look around.
"What are you supposed to be doing?" George asked. "Walking on Commonwealth Avenue? You couldn't fool my old blind granny. Just do it, huh?"
"Okay, I was just..."
"Yeah, I know what you was just. Keep your mind on your business."
"Okay."
"What are you, Blaze?"
He hung his head, snorkeled back snot. "I'm a dummy." George always said there was no shame in this, but it was a fact, and you had to recognize it. You couldn't fool anybody into thinking you were smart. They looked at you and saw the truth. The lights were on, but nobody was home. If you were a dummy, you had to just do your business and get out. And if you were caught, you owned up to everything except the guys who were with you, because they'd get everything else out of you in the end anyway. George said dummies couldn't lie worth shit. Blaze took his hands out of his pockets and flexed them twice. The knuckles popped in the cold, still air.
"You ready, big man?" George asked.
"Yes."
"Then I'm going to get a beer. Take care of it."
Blaze felt panic start. It came up his throat. Hey, no! I ain't never done this before. I just watched you.
Well, this time you're gonna do more than watch.
But... He stopped. There was no sense going on unless he wanted to shout. He could hear the hard crunch of packed snow as George headed toward the beer joint. Soon his footsteps were lost in the heartbeat of the bass.
Jesus, Blaze said. Oh, Jesus Christ.
And his fingers were getting cold. At this temperature, they'd only be good for 5 minutes, maybe less. He went around to the driver's side door, thinking the door would be locked. If the door was locked, this car was no good because he didn't have the Slim Jim. George had the Slim Jim. Only the door was unlocked. He opened the door, reached in, found the hood release, and pulled it. Then he went around front, fiddled for the second catch, found that one, and lifted the hood. There was a small penlight in his pocket. He took it out. He turned it on and trained the beam on the engine. Find the ignition wire. But there was so much spaghetti. Battery cables, hoses, spark plug wires, the gas line. He stood there with sweat running down the sides of his face and freezing on his cheeks. This was no good. This wouldn't never be no good. And all at once, he had an idea. It wasn't a very good idea, but he didn't have many. And when he had one, he had to chase it. He went back to the driver's side and opened the door again. The light came on, but he couldn't help that. If someone saw him fiddling around, they would just think he was having trouble getting started. Sure, cold night like this, that made sense, didn't it? Even George couldn't give him grief on that one. Not much, anyway. He flipped down the visor over the steering wheel, hoping against hope that a spare key might flop down. Sometimes folks kept one up there. But there was nothing except an old ice scraper. That flopped down. He tried the glove compartment next. It was full of papers. He raked them out onto the floor, kneeling on the seat to do it, his breath puffing. There were papers and a box of junior mints, but no keys.
There, you goddamn dummy, he heard George saying. Are you satisfied now? Ready to at least try hot-wiring it now?
He supposed he was. He supposed he could at least tear some of the wires loose and touch them together like George did and see what happened. He closed the door and started toward the front of the Ford again with his head down. Then he stopped. A new idea had struck him. He went back, opened the door, bent down, flipped up the floor mat, and there it was. The key didn't say Ford on it. It didn't say anything on it because it was a dupe. But it had the right square head and everything. Blaze picked it up and kissed the cold metal. Unlocked car, he thought. Then he thought, unlocked car and key under the floor mat. Then he thought, I ain't the dumbest guy out tonight after all, George. He got in behind the wheel, slammed the door, slid the key in the ignition slot, it went in nice, then realized he couldn't see the parking lot because the hood was still up. He looked around quick, first one way and then the other, making sure that George hadn't decided to come back and help him out. George would never let him hear the end of it if he saw the hood still up like that. But George wasn't there. No one was there. The parking lot was tundra with cars. Blaze got out and slammed the hood. Then he got back in and paused in the act of reaching for the door handle. What about George? Should he go in yonder beer farm and get him? Blaze sat frowning, head down. The dome light cast yellow light on his big hands. Guess what? He thought, raising his head again at last. Screw him. Screw you, George, he said. George had left him to hitchhike in, just meeting him here. Then left him again. Left him to do the dirty work. And it was only by the dumbest of dumb luck that Blaze had found a key, so screw George. Let him thumb a ride back in the 3-degree cold. Blaze closed the door, dropped the gear shift in to drive, and pulled out of the parking space. Once in an actual lane of travel, he stomped down heavily, and the Ford leaped, rear-end fishtailing on the hard-packed snow. He slammed on the brakes, stiff with panic. What was he doing? What was he thinking of? Go without George? He'd get picked up before he went 5 miles. Probably get picked up at the first stop-and-go light. He couldn't go without George. But George is dead. That was bullshit. George was just there. He went inside for a beer. He's dead.
Oh, George, Blaze moaned. He was hunched over the wheel. Oh, George, don't be dead.
He sat there a while. The Ford's engine sounded okay. It wasn't knocking or anything, even though it was cold. The gas gauge said 3/4. The exhaust rose in the rear view, white and frozen. George didn't come out of the beer joint. He couldn't come out, 'cause he never went in. George was dead. Had been 3 months. Blaze started to shake. After a little bit, he caught hold of himself. He began to drive. No one stopped him at the first traffic light or the second. No one stopped him all the way out of town. By the time he got to the apex town line, he was doing 50. Sometimes the car slid a little on patches of ice, but this didn't bother him. He just turned with the skid. He had been driving on icy roads since he was a teenager. Outside of town, he pushed the Ford to 60 and let it ride. The high beams poked the road with bright fingers and rebounded brilliantly from the snowbanks on either side. Boy, there was going to be one surprised college kid when he took his college girl back to that empty slot. She'd look at him and say, "You are a dummy. I ain't going with you again. Not here or nowhere." "Aren't," Blaze said. "If she's a college girl, she'll say aren't." That made him smile. The smile changed his whole face. He turned on the radio. It was tuned to rock. Blaze turned the knob until he found country. By the time he reached the shack, he was singing along with the radio at the top of his voice, and he had forgotten all about George. Chapter 2. But he remembered the next morning. That was the curse of being a dummy. You were always being surprised by grief because you could never remember the important things. The only stuff that stuck was dumb stuff. Like that poem Mrs. Selig made them learn way back in the 5th grade. "Under the spreading chestnut tree, the village smithy stands." What good was that? What good when you caught yourself peeling potatoes for 2 and got smacked all over again with knowing you didn't need to peel no 2 potatoes because the other guy was never going to eat another spud? Well, maybe it wasn't grief. Maybe that word wasn't the right word. Not if that meant crying and knocking your head against the wall. You didn't do that for the likes of George. But there was loneliness. And there was fear. George would say,
"Jesus, would you change your fucking skivvies? Those things are ready to stand up on their own. They're disgusting."
George would say,
"You only tied one, dim bulb."
George would say,
"Oh, fuck, turn around and I'll tuck it in. Like having a kid."
When he got up the morning after he stole the Ford, George was sitting in the other room. Blaze couldn't see him, but he knew he was sitting in the broke-down easy chair like always, with his head down so his chin was almost on his chest. The first thing he said was,
"You screwed up again, Kong. Congratulations."
Blaze hissed when his feet hit the cold floor. Then he fumbled his shoes on. Naked except for them, he ran and looked out the window. No car. He sighed with relief. It came out in a little puff he could see. "No, I didn't. I put it in the shed, just like you told me."
"You didn't wipe the goddamn tracks, though, did you? Why don't you put out a sign, Blaze? 'This way to the hot car. You could charge admission.' Why don't you just do that?"
"Oh, George.
Oh, George. Oh, George. Go out and sweep 'em up."
"Okay." He started for the door.
"Blaze."
"What?"
Put on your fucking pants first, why don't you?
Blaze felt his face burn.
Like a kid, George said, sounding resigned. One who can't shave.
George knew how to stick it in, all right. Only finally he'd gone and stuck it in the wrong guy, too often and too far. That was how you ended up dead, with nothing smart to say. Now George was just dead, and Blaze was making his voice up in his mind, giving him the good lines. George had been dead since that crap game in the warehouse. I'm crazy for even trying to go through with this, Blaze thought. A dum-dum like me. But he pulled on his underwear shorts, checking them carefully for stains first, then a thermal undershirt, then a flannel top shirt and a pair of heavy corduroy pants. His Sears work boots were under the bed. His army surplus parka was hanging on the doorknob. He hunted for his mittens and finally found them on the shelf over the dilapidated wood stove in the combination kitchen-living room. He got his checkered cap with the ear flaps and put it on, careful to give the visor a little good-luck twist to the left. Then he went out and got the broom leaning against the door. The morning was bright and bitter. The moisture in his nose crackled immediately. A gust of wind drove snow as fine as powdered sugar into his face, making him wince. It was all right for George to give orders. George was inside drinking coffee by the stove. Like last night, taking off for a beer, leaving Blaze to figure out the car. And there he would still be if he hadn't had the dumb luck to find the keys somewhere, either under the floor mat or in the glove compartment, he forgot which. Sometimes he didn't think George was a very good friend. He swept the tracks away with the broom, pausing several minutes to admire them before he started. How the treads stood up and cast shadows mostly, little perfect things. It was funny how little things could be so perfect and no one ever saw them. He looked at this until he was tired of looking. No George to tell him to hurry up, and then worked his way down the short driveway to the road, brushing the tracks away. The plow had gone by in the night, pushing back the snow dunes the wind made across these country roads, where there were open fields to one side and t'other, and any other tracks were gone. Blaze tromped back to the shack. He went inside. Now it felt warm inside. Getting out of bed, it had felt cold. But now, it felt warm. That was funny, too. How your sense of things could change. He took off his coat and boots and flannel shirt and sat down to the table in his undershirt and cords. He turned on the radio, and was surprised when it didn't play the rock George listened to, but warmed right up to country. Loretta Lynn was singing that your good girl is gonna go bad. George would laugh and say something like,
"That's right, honey. You can go bad all over my face."
And Blaze would laugh, too. But down deep, that song always made him sad. Lots of country songs did. When the coffee was hot, he jumped up and poured two cups. He loaded one with cream and hollered, "George, here's your coffee, hoss. Don't let it go cold." No answer. He looked down at the white coffee. He didn't drink coffee with, so what about it? Just what about it? Something came up in his throat then, and he almost hucked George's goddamn white coffee across the room. But then he didn't. He took it over sink and poured it down instead. That was controlling your temper. When you were a big guy, you had to do that, or get in trouble. Blaze hung around the shack until after lunch. Then he drove the stolen car out of the shed, stopping by the kitchen steps long enough to get out and throw snowballs at the license plates. That was pretty smart. It would make them hard to read.
"What in the name of God are you doing?" George asked from inside the shed.
"Never mind," Blaze said. "You're only in my head anyway." He got in the Ford and drove out to the road.
"This isn't very bright," George said.
Now he was in the back seat.
"You're driving around in a stolen car. No fresh paint job, no fresh plates, no nothing. Where you going?"
Blaze didn't say anything.
You ain't going to a coma, are you?
Blaze didn't say anything.
Oh, fuck, you are, George said. Fuck me. Isn't the once you have to go enough?
Blaze didn't say anything. He was dummied up.
Listen to me, Blaze. Turn around. You get picked up, it's out the window. Everything. The whole deal.
Blaze knew that was right, but wouldn't turn back. Why should George always get to order him around? Even dead, he wouldn't stop giving orders. Sure, it was George's plan, that one big score every small-timer dreams of.
Only we could really make it happen, he'd say. But usually when he was drunk or high, and never like he really believed it.
They had spent most of their time running two-man short cons, and mostly George seemed satisfied with that, no matter what he said when he was drunk or getting his smoke on. Maybe the Okoma Heights score was just a game for George, or what he sometimes called mental masturbation when he saw guys in suits talking about politics on TV. Blaze knew George was smart. It was his guts he had never been sure of. But now that he was dead, what choice? Blaze was no good by himself. The one time he tried running the menswear con after George's death, he'd had to book like a bastard to keep from being picked up. He got the lady's name out of the obituary column just the way George did. Had started in on George's spiel, had shown the credit slips, there was a whole bag of them at the shack, and from the best stores. He told her about how sad he was to have to come by at such a sad time. But business was business, and he was sure she would understand that. She said she did. She invited him to stand in the foyer while she got her pocketbook. He never suspected that she had called the police. If she hadn't come back and pointed a gun at him, he probably would have still been standing there waiting when the police hoed up. His time sense had never been good. But she came back with a gun and pointed it at him. It was a silver lady's gun with little swoops on the sides and pearl handles. "The police are on their way," she said. "But before they get here, I want you to explain yourself. I want you to tell me what kind of a lowlife preys on a woman whose husband isn't even cold in his grave yet." Blaze didn't care what she wanted him to tell her. He turned and ran out the door and across the porch and down the steps to the walk. He could run pretty good once he got going, but he was slow getting going, and the panic made him slower that day. If she had pulled the trigger, she might have put a bullet in the back of his big head, or shot off an ear, or missed him entirely. With a little short barrel shooter like that, you couldn't tell. But she never fired. When he got back to the shack, he was half moaning with fear, and his stomach was tied in knots. He wasn't afraid of jail or the penitentiary, not even of the police. Although he knew they would confuse him with their questions, they always did. But he was afraid of how easy she saw through him. Like it wasn't nothing to her. They had hardly ever seen through George. And when they did, he always knew it was happening, and got them out. And now this. He wasn't going to get away with it. Knew it. Kept on anyway. Maybe he wanted to go back inside. Maybe that wouldn't be so bad, now that George was wasted. Let someone else do the thinking and provide the meals. Maybe he was trying to get caught right now, driving this hot car through the middle of Okoma Heights, right past the Girard house. In the icebox of New England winter, it looked like a frozen palace. Okoma Heights was old money, that's what George said, and the houses were really estates. They were surrounded by big lawns in the summertime. But now the lawns were glazed snowfields. It had been a hard winter. The Girard house was the best one of all. George called it early American hot shit, but Blaze thought it was beautiful. George said the Girards had made their money in shipping, that World War I made them rich, and World War II made them holy. Snow and sun struck cold fire from the many windows. George said there were over 30 rooms. He had done the preliminary work as a meter reader from Central Valley Power. That had been in September. Blaze had driven the truck, which was borrowed rather than stolen, although he supposed the police would have called it stolen if they'd been caught. People were playing croquet on the side lawn. Some were girls, high school girls or maybe college girls, good-looking. Blaze watched them and started feeling horny. When George got back in and told him to wheel it, Blaze told him about the good-looking girls who had gone around to the back by then.
"I saw 'em," George said. "Think they're better than anybody. Think their shit don't stink."
"Pretty, though."
"Who gives a rat's ass?" George asked moodily, and crossed his arms over his chest.
"Don't you ever get horny, George?"
"Over babies like that? You jest. I shut up and drive."
Now, remembering that, Blaze smiled. George was like the fox who couldn't reach the grapes and told everyone they were sour. Miss Jolison read them that story in the second grade. It was a big family. There were the old Mr. and Mrs. Gerard. He was 80 and still able to put away a pint of Jack a day, that's what George said. There was the middle Mr. and Mrs. Gerard, and then there was the young Mr. and Mrs. Gerard. The young Mr. Gerard was Joseph Gerard III, and he really was young, just 25. His wife was a Narmenian. George said that made her a spick. Blaze had thought only Italians could be spicks. He turned around up the street and cruised past the house once more, wondering what it felt like to be married at 22. He kept on going, heading home. Enough was enough. The middle Gerards had other kids besides Joseph Gerard III, but they didn't matter. What mattered was the baby, Joseph Gerard IV. Big name for such a little baby. He was only 2 months old when Blaze and George did their meter reading bit in September. That made him, there were 4 months between September and January, 6 months old. He was the original Joe's only great-grandson.
"If you're gonna pull a snatch, you gotta snatch a baby," George said. "A baby can't ID you, so you can return it alive. It can't fuck you up by trying to escape or sending out notes or some shit. All a baby can do is lie there. It don't even know it's been snatched."
They'd been in the shack, sitting in front of the TV and drinking beer. "How much do you think they'd be good for?" Blaze asked.
"Enough so you'd never have to spend another winter day freezing your ass off selling fake magazine subscriptions or collecting for the Red Cross," George said. "How's that sound?"
"But how much would you ask?"
$2 million, George said. "One for you and one for me. Why be greedy?"
"Greedies get caught," Blaze said.
"Greedies get caught," George agreed. "That's what I taught you. But what's the workman worthy of, Blazerino? What'd I teach you about that?"
"His hire," Blaze said.
"That's right," George said, and hit his beer. "The workman's worthy of his fucking hire."
So here he was, driving back to the miserable shack where he and George had been living since drifting north from Boston, actually planning to go through with it. He thought he would be caught, but $2 million. You could go someplace and never be cold again. And if they caught you, the worst they could do is put you in jail for life. And if that happened, you'd still never be cold again. When the stolen Ford was back in the shed, he remembered to brush the tracks away. That would make George happy. He made himself a couple of hamburgers for his lunch.
"You really going through with it?" George asked from the other room.
"You lying down, George?"
"No, standing on my head and jerking off. I asked you a question."
"I'm gonna try. Will you help me?"
George sighed. "I guess I'll have to. I'm stuck with you now. But Blaze..."
"What, George?"
"Only ask for $1 million. Greedies get caught."
"Okay. Only $1 million. You want a hamburger?" No answer. George was dead again. Chapter 3. He was getting ready to do the kidnapping that night. The sooner the better. George stopped him.
What are you up to, Dinkleballs?
Blaze had been getting ready to go start the Ford. Now he stopped. Getting ready to do it, George.
Do what?
Snatch the kid. George laughed.
What you laughing at, George?
As if I don't know, he thought.
You?
Why?
How are you gonna snatch him? Tell me that.
Blaze frowned. It turned his face, already ugly, into the face of a troll. The way we planned it, I guess. Out in his room.
Which room?
Well,
how are you gonna get in?
He remembered that part. One of the upstairs windows. They got those simple catches on them. You saw that, George. When we was being the electric company, remember?
Got a ladder?
Well,
when you get the kid, where you gonna put him?
In the car, George.
Oh, my fucking word.
George only said this when he had bottomed out and was at a loss for all other expression.
George, I know you were gonna put him in a fucking car. I never thought you were gonna carry him home piggyback. I meant, when you get him back here, what are you gonna do then? Where you gonna put him?
Blaze thought about the shack. He looked around. Well?
What about Didi's? What about bottles and baby food? Or did you think he was gonna have a hamburger and a bottle of beer for his fucking dinner?
Well,
shut up! You say that one more time and I'm gonna puke.
Blaze sat down in a kitchen chair with his head down. His face was hot.
And turn off the shit-kicking music. That woman sounds like she's about to fly up her own cunt.
Okay, George. Blaze turned off the radio. The TV, an old Jap thing George picked up at a yard sale, was busted. George? No answer.
George, come on. Don't go away. I'm sorry.
He could hear how scared he was, almost blubbing.
Okay, George said, just when Blaze was about to give up. Here's what you have to do. You have to pull a little score. Not a big one, just a little one. That mom and pop where we used to stop for suds off Route 1 would probably be okay.
Yeah?
You still got the Colt?
Under the bed in the shoebox.
Use that. And wear a stocking over your face, otherwise the guy who works nights will recognize you.
Yeah.
Go in Saturday night at closing. Say 1:50. They don't take checks, so you ought to get $200-300.
Sure, that's great.
Blaze, one more thing.
What, George?
Take the bullets out of the gun, okay?
Sure, George, I know that. It's how we roll.
It's how we roll, right. Hit the guy if you have to, but make sure it doesn't get to no more than page 3 in State and Local when it makes the paper.
Right.
You're an asshole, Blaze. You know that, right? You're never gonna bring this off. Maybe it'd be better if you got caught on the little one.
I won't, George. No answer. George? No answer. Blaze got up and turned on the radio. At supper, he forgot and set 2 places. Chapter 4 Clayton Blaisdell Jr. was born in Freeport, Maine. His mother was hit by a truck 3 years later while crossing Main Street with a bag of groceries. She was killed instantly. The driver was drunk and driving without a license. In court, he said he was sorry. He cried. He said he would go back to AA. The judge fined him and gave him 60 days. Little Clay got life with father, who knew plenty about drinking and nothing about AA. Clayton Sr. worked for Superior Mills in Topsom, where he ran the picker and sorter. Co-workers claimed to have seen him do his job sober upon occasion. Clay could already read when he started the first grade, and grasped the concept of 2 apples plus 3 apples with no trouble. He was big for his size even then. And although Freeport was a tough town, He had no trouble on the playground, even though he was rarely seen there without a book in his hand or tucked under his arm. His father was bigger, however, and the other kids always found it interesting to see what would be bandaged and what would be bruised when Clay Blaisdell came to school on Mondays. It will be a miracle if he gets his size without being badly hurt or killed, Sarah Jolison remarked one day in the teacher's room. The miracle didn't happen. One hungover Saturday morning when not much was doing, Clayton Sr. staggered out of the bedroom in the second-floor apartment he and his son shared while Clay was sitting cross-legged on the living room floor, watching cartoons and eating Apple Jacks.
"How many times have I told you not to eat that shit in here?" Sr. inquired of Jr., then picked him up and threw him downstairs.
Clay landed on his head. His father went down, got him, toted him upstairs and threw him down again. The first time, Clay remained conscious. The second time, the lights went out. His father went down, got him, toted him upstairs, and looked him over.
"Faking son of a bitch," he said, and threw him down again. "There," he told the limp huddle at the foot of the stairs that was now his comatose son. "Maybe you'll think twice before you tote that fucking shit into the living room again."
Unfortunately, Clay never thought twice about much of anything again. He lay unconscious in Portland General Hospital for 3 weeks. The doctor in charge of his case voiced the opinion that he would remain so until he died, a human carrot. But the boy woke up. He was, unfortunately, soft in the head. His days of carrying books under his arm were over. The authorities did not believe Clay's father when he told them the boy had done all that damage falling downstairs once. Nor did they believe him when he said the 4 half-healed cigarette burns on the boy's chest were the result of some kind of Phelan disease. The boy never saw the second-floor apartment again. He was made a ward of the state and went directly from the hospital to a county home, where his parentless life began by having his crutches kicked out from under him on the playground by 2 boys who ran away chortling like trolls. Clay picked himself up and reset his crutches. He did not cry. His father did some protesting in the Freeport police station and more in several Freeport bars. He threatened to go to law in order to regain his son, but never did. He claimed to love Clay, and perhaps he did, a little. But if so, his love was the kind that bites and burns. The boy was better off out of his reach. But not much better. Hetton House in South Freeport was little more than a poor farm for kids. And Clay's childhood there was wretched, although a little better when his body was mended. Then, at least, he could make the worst of the bullies stand away from him in the play yard, him and the few younger children who came to look to him for protection. The bullies called him Lunk and Troll and Kong, but he minded none of those names, and he left them alone if they left him alone. Mostly they did after he licked the worst of them. He wasn't mean, but when provoked, he could be dangerous. The kids who weren't afraid of him called him Blaze, and that was how he came to think of himself. Once he had a letter from his father.
"Dear son," it said. "Well, how are you doing? I am fine. Working these days up in Lincoln rolling lumber. It would be good if the bastards didn't steal all the overtime. Ha! I'm going to get a little place and will send for you once I do. Well, write me a little letter, and tell your old pa how it goes. Can you send a photo?" It was signed, "With love, Clayton Blaisdell."
Blaze had no photo to send his father, but would have written. The music teacher who came on Tuesdays would have helped him, he was quite sure. But there was no return address on the envelope, which was dirty, and simply addressed to Clayton Blaisdell, Jr., the orphan home in Freeport, Maine. Blaze never heard from him again. He was placed with several different families during his Hetton House tenure, every time in the fall. They kept him long enough to help pick the crops and help keep their roofs and dooryards shoveled. Then, when spring thaw came, they decided he wasn't quite right and sent him back. Sometimes it wasn't too bad. And sometimes, like with the Bowies and their horrible dog farm, it was real bad. When he and the HH were quits, Blaze knocked around New England on his own. Sometimes he was happy, but not the way he wanted to be happy. Not the way he saw people being happy. When he finally settled in Boston, more or less, he never put down roots, it was because in the country he was lonely. Sometimes when he was in the country, he would sleep in a barn and wake in the night and go out and look at the stars. And there were so many, and he knew they were there before him, and they would be there after him. That was sort of awful and sort of wonderful. Sometimes when he was hitchhiking, and it was going on for November, the wind would blow around him and flap his pants, and he would grieve for something that was lost, like that letter, which had come with no address. Sometimes he would look at the sky in the spring and see a bird, and it might make him happy. But just as often, it felt like something inside him was getting small and ready to break. "It's bad to feel like that," he would think. "And if I do, I shouldn't be watching no birds." But sometimes he would look up at the sky anyway. Boston was all right, but sometimes he still got scared. There were a million people in the city, maybe more, and not one gave a shake for Clay Blaisdell. If they looked at him, it was only because he was big and had a dent in his forehead. Sometimes he would have a little fun, and sometimes he would just get frightened. He was trying to have a little fun in Boston when he met George Rackley. After he met George, it was better. Chapter 5. The little mom-and-pop store was Tim and Janet's Quick Pick. Most of the rear shelves were overflowing with jug wine and beer stacked in cardboard cases. A giant cooler ran the length of the back wall. Two of the four aisles were dedicated to munchies. Beside the cash register stood a bottle of pickled eggs as large as a small child. Tim and Janet's also stocked such necessaries as cigarettes, sanitary napkins, hot dogs, and stroke books. The night man was a pimple-pocked dude who attended the Portland branch of the University of Maine during his days. His name was Harry Nason, and he was majoring in animal husbandry. When the big man with a dented forehead walked in at 1:50, Nason was reading a book from the paperback rack. The book was called Big and Hard. The late-night rush had dried up to a trickle. Nason decided that after the big man had bought his jug or his six, he'd close up and go home, maybe take the book along and beat off. He was thinking that the part about the traveling preacher and the two horny widows might be good for that, when the big man put a pistol under his nose and said, "Everything in the register." Nason dropped the book. Thoughts of beating off left his mind. He gaped at the gun. He opened his mouth to say something intelligent, the kind of thing a guy being stuck up on TV might say, if the guy being stuck up happened to be the hero of the show. What came out was, "Everything in the register," the big man repeated. The dent in his forehead was frightening. It looked deep enough for a frog pond. Harry Nason recalled, in a frozen sort of way, what his boss had told him he should do in the event of a holdup. Give the robber everything with no argument. He was fully insured. Nason's body suddenly felt very tender and vulnerable, full of bags and waters. His bladder loosened, and all at once he seemed to have an absolute assful of shit. "Did you hear me, man?" Harry Nason agreed, and punched "no sale" on the cash register. "Put the money in a bag."
"Okay, yes, sure."
He fumbled among the sacks under the counter and dumped most of them on the floor. At last he managed to hold on to one. He flipped up the bill holders in the cash drawer and began to drop money into the bag. The door opened, and a guy and a girl, probably college kids, walked in. They saw the gun and stopped.
"What's this?" the guy asked.
He was smoking a cigarillo and wearing a button that said, "Pot Rocks."
"It's a holdup," Nason said. "Please don't, antagonize this gentleman."
"Too much," the guy with the Pot Rocks button said. He started to grin. He pointed at Nason. His fingernail was dirty.
"Dude's ripping you off, man."
The holdup man turned to Pot Rocks. "Wallet," he said.
"Dude," Pot Rocks said, not losing the grin, "I'm on your side. The prices this place charges, and everybody knows Tim and Janet Quarles are like the biggest right-wingers since Adolf. Give me your wallet, or I'll blow your head off."
Pot Rocks suddenly realized he might be in some trouble here. For sure he wasn't in a movie. The grin went bye-bye and he stopped talking. Several zits stood out brightly on his cheeks, which were suddenly pale. He dug a black Lord Buxton out of his jeans pocket.
"There's never a cop when you need one," his girlfriend said coldly.
She was wearing a long brown coat and black leather boots. Her hair matched the boots, at least this week.
"Drop the wallet in the bag," the holdup guy said.
He held the bag out. Harry Nason always thought he could have become a hero at that point by braining the holdup man with a giant bottle of pickled eggs. Only the holdup man looked as if he might have had a hard head. Very hard. The wallet plopped into the bag. The holdup man skirted them and headed for the door. He moved well for a man his size.
"You pig," the girl said.
The holdup man stopped dead. For a moment, the girl was sure, so she later told police, that he was going to turn around, open fire, and lay them all out. Later, with the police, they would differ on the holdup man's hair color. Brown, reddish, or blonde, his complexion, fair, ruddy, or pale, and his clothes, pea jacket, windbreaker, woolen lumberjack shirt. But they all agreed on his size, big, and his final words before leaving. These were apparently addressed to the blank, dark doorway almost in a moan.
"Jesus, George, I forgot the stocking!"
Then he was gone. There was a bare glimpse of him running in the cold white light of the big Schlitz sign that hung over the store's entrance, and then an engine roared across the street. A moment later he wheeled out. The car was a sedan, but none of them could ID the make or model. It was beginning to snow.
"So much for beer," Pot Rocks said.
"Go on back to the cooler and have one on the house," said Harry Nason.
"Yeah? You sure?"
"Sure, I'm sure. Your girl, too. What the fuck? We're insured."
He began to laugh. When the police asked him, he said he had never seen the stick-up guy before. It was only later that he had cause to wonder if he had not, in fact, seen the stick-up guy the previous fall, in the company of a skinny little rat-faced man who was buying wine and mouthing off.
Chapter 6. When Blaze got up the next morning, snow had piled in drifts all the way to the eaves of the shack, and the fire was out. His bladder contracted the second his feet hit the floor. He hurried to the bathroom on the balls of his feet, wincing and blowing out little puffs of white vapor. His urine arched in a high pressure flow for perhaps 30 seconds, then slowly faded. He sighed, shook off, broke wind. Much bigger wind was screaming and whooping around the house. The pines outside the kitchen window were dipping and swaying. To Blaze, they looked like thin women at a funeral. He dressed, opened the back door, and fought his way around to the woodpile under the south eaves. The driveway was completely gone,
Visibility was down to 5 feet, maybe less. It exhilarated him. The grainy slap of the snow on his face exhilarated him. The wood was solid chunks of oak. He gathered a huge armful, pausing only to stomp his feet before going back in. He made up the fire with his coat on. Then he filled the coffee pot. He carried 2 cups to the table. He paused, frowning. He had forgotten something. The money! He had never counted the money. He started into the other room. George's voice froze him. George was in the bathroom.
Asshole!
George?
George, I'm an asshole. Can you say that?
No.
Say, George, I'm the asshole who forgot to wear the stocking.
I got the money.
Say it.
George, I'm the asshole. I forgot.
Forgot what?
Forgot to wear the stocking.
Now, say all of it.
George, I'm the asshole who forgot to wear the stocking.
Now say this. Say, George, I'm the asshole who wants to get caught.
No, that ain't true. That's a lie, George.
It's the truth is what it is. You want to get caught and go to Shawshank and work in a laundry. That's the truth. The whole truth and nothing but the truth. That's the truth on a stick. You bull simple. That's the truth.
No, George, it ain't. I promise.
I'm going away.
No!
Panic seemed to stop his breath. It was like the sleeve of the flannel shirt his old man had crammed down his throat once to stop him bawling.
Don't. I forgot. I'm a dummy. Without you, I'll never remember what to buy.
You have a nice time, Blazer, George said.
And although his voice was still coming from the bathroom, now it seemed to be fading.
You have a good time getting caught. Have a good time doing time and ironing those sheets.
I'll do everything you tell me. I won't fuck up again.
There was a long pause. Blaze thought George was gone.
Maybe I'll be back. But I don't think so.
George! George?
The coffee was boiling. He poured 1 cup and went into the bedroom. The brown sack with the money in it was under George's side of the mattress. He shook it out on the sheet, which he kept forgetting to change. It had been on for the whole 3 months George had been dead. There was $260 from the little mom and pop, another $80 from the college boy's wallet. More than enough to buy... what? What was he supposed to buy? Diapers, that was the ticket. If you were gonna snatch a baby, you had to have diapers. Other stuff, too. But he couldn't remember the other stuff. What was it besides diapers, George? He said it with an air of offhand casualness, hoping to surprise George into speech. But George didn't take the bait.
Maybe I'll be back, but I don't think so.
He put the money back in the brown bag and exchanged the college kid's wallet for his own, which was battered and scuffed and full of nicks. His own wallet held 2 greasy dollar bills, a faded Kodak of his old man and old lady with their arms around each other, and a photo booth shot of him and his only real buddy from Hetton House, John Cheltzman. There was also his lucky Kennedy half dollar, an old bill for a muffler that had been when he and George had been running that big bad Pontiac Bonneville, and a folded over Polaroid. George was looking out of the Polaroid and smiling, squinting a little, because the sun had been in his eyes. He was wearing jeans and workman's boots. His hat was twisted around to the left, like he always wore it. George said that was the good luck side. They worked a lot of gags, and most of them, the best of them, were easy to work. Some depended on misdirection, some on greed, and some on fear. They were what George called short cons, and he called the gags that depended on fear short con heartstoppers.
I like the simple shit, George said. Why do I like the simple shit, Blaze?
Not many moving parts, Blaze said.
Correct-a-rooney. Not many moving parts.
In the best of the short con heart stoppers, George dressed up in clothes he called a little past sharp, and then toward some Boston bars he knew about. These weren't gay bars, and they weren't straight bars. George called them gray bars, and the mark always picked George up. George never had to make a move. Blaze had pondered this once or twice in his ponderous way, but had never come to any conclusion about it. George had a nose for the closet queers and the AC/DC swingers who went out once or twice a month with their wedding rings tucked away in their wallets. The wholesalers on their way up, the insurance men, the school administrators, the bright young bank executives. George said they had a smell, and he was kind to them. He helped them along when they were shy and couldn't find the right words. Then he'd say he was staying at a good hotel, not a great hotel, but a good one, a safe one. It was the Imperial, not far from Chinatown. George and Blaze had a deal going with the second shift desk man and the bell captain. The room they used might change, but it was always at the end of the hall, and never too close to another occupied room. Blaze sat in the lobby from 3 to 11, wearing clothes he wouldn't be caught dead in on the street. His hair always gleamed with oil. He read comic books while waiting for George. He was never aware of passing time. The true indicator of George's genius was that when he and the Mark came in, the Mark hardly ever looked nervous, eager, but not nervous. Blaze gave them 15 minutes, then went up.
"Never think about it as coming in the room," George said. "Think of it as going on stage. The only one who don't know it's showtime is the Mark."
Blaze always used his key and walked on stage saying his first line.
"Hank, darling, I'm so glad to be back."
Then he got mad, which he did passably well, although probably not up to Hollywood standards.
"Jesus, no! I'll kill him! Kill him!"
At that, he would heave his 300-pound bulk at the bed, where the Mark quivered in horror, by that time usually wearing only his socks. George would throw himself between the Mark and his raging boyfriend at the last moment. A flimsy barrier at best, the Mark would think, if he was capable of thinking, and the soap opera was on.
"George." "Dana, listen to me. This isn't what it seems."
"Blaze." "I'm gonna kill him. Get out of my way and let me kill him. I'm gonna throw him out the window."
Terrified squeals from the Marks. There had been 8 or 10 in all.
"George." "Please, let me tell you."
"Blaze." "I'm gonna rip his balls off."
The Mark begins to plead for his life and his sexual equipment, not necessarily in that order.
"George." "No, you're not. You're going to go quietly down to the lobby and wait for me."
At this point, Blaze would make another lunge for the Mark. George would restrain him, barely. Blaze would then tear the wallet from the Mark's pants.
"Blaze." "I got your name and address, bitch. I'm gonna call your wife."
At this point, most Marks forgot about their lives and their sexual equipment and began to concentrate on their sacred honor and neighborhood standing instead. Blaze found this strange, but it seemed always to be true. More truth was to be found in a Mark's wallet. The Mark would tell George he was Bill Smith from New Rochelle. He was, of course, Dan Donahue from Brookline. The play, meanwhile, resumed. The show had to go on.
"George." "Go downstairs, Dana. Be a dear, and go downstairs."
"Blaze." "No!"
"George." "Go downstairs, or I will never speak to you again. I am sick of your tantrums and your possessiveness. I mean it."
At this point, Blaze would go, clutching the wallet to his breast, muttering threats, and making baleful eye contact with the Mark. As soon as the door closed, the Mark was all over George. He had to have his wallet back. He would do anything to get his wallet back. The money didn't matter, but the identification did. If Sally found out, and Junior, oh God, think of little Junior. George soothed the Mark, He was good at this part. Perhaps, he would say, Dana could be reasoned with. In fact, Dana could almost certainly be reasoned with. He just needed a few minutes to cool down, and then for George to talk to him alone, to reason with him, and pet him a little, the big lunk. Blaze, of course, was not in the lobby. Blaze was in a room on the second floor. When George went down there, they would count the take. Their worst score was $43. Their best, taken from the executive of a large food chain, was $550. They gave the mark enough time to sweat and make bleak promises to himself. George gave the mark time enough. George always knew the right amount. It was amazing. It was like he had a clock in his head, and it was set different for each mark. At last he would return to the first room with the wallet and say that Dana finally listened to reason. But he won't give back the money. George had all he could do to make him give back the credit cards. Sorry. The mark doesn't give a tinker's damn about the money. He is thumbing through his wallet feverishly, making sure he still has his driver's license, Blue Cross card, Social Security, pictures. It's all there. Thank God it's all there. Poorer but wiser, he dresses and creeps away, probably wishing his balls had never dropped in the first place. During the 4 years before Blaze took his second fall, this con was the one they fell back on, and it never failed. They never had a bit of trouble from the heat, either. Although not bright, Blaze was a fine actor. George was only the second real friend he had ever had, and it was only necessary to pretend that the mark was trying to persuade George that Blaze was no good, that Blaze was a waste of George's time and talents, that Blaze, in addition to being a dummy, was a busher and a fuck-up. Once Blaze had convinced himself of these things, his rage became genuine. If George had stood aside, Blaze would have broken both of the mark's arms, maybe killed him. Now, turning the Polaroid snap over and over in his fingers, Blaze felt empty. He felt like when he looked up in the sky and saw the stars, or a bird on a telephone wire or chimney with its feathers blowing. George was gone, and he was still stupid. He was in a fix, and there was no way out. Unless maybe he could show George he was at least smart enough to get this thing rolling. Unless he could show George he didn't mean to get caught. Which meant what? Which meant diapers. Diapers and what else? Jesus, what else? He fell into a doze of thought. He thought all that morning, which passed with snow whooping in its throat. Chapter 7. He was out of place in the baby shop of Hager's Mammoth department store as a boulder in a living room. He was wearing his jeans and his work boots with the rawhide laces, a flannel shirt, and a black leather belt with the buckle cinched on the left side, the good luck side. He had remembered his hat this time, the one with the ear flaps, and he carried it in one hand. He was standing in the middle of a mostly pink room that was filled with light. He looked left, and there were changing tables. He looked right, and there were carriages. He felt like he'd landed on Planet Baby. There were many women here. Some had big bellies, and some had small babies. Many of the babies were crying, and all of the women looked at Blaze cautiously, as if he might go berserk at any moment and begin laying waste to Planet Baby, sending torn cushions and ripped teddy bears flying. A sales lady approached. Blaze was thankful. He had been afraid to speak to anyone. He knew when people were afraid, and he knew where he didn't belong. He was dumb, but not that dumb. The sales lady asked if he needed help. Blaze said he did. He had been unable to think of everything he needed, no matter how hard he tried, and so resorted to the only form of subterfuge with which he was familiar, the con. "I've been out of state," he said, and bared his teeth at the sales lady in a grin that would have frightened a cougar. The sales lady smiled back bravely.
The top of her head almost reached the midpoint of his ribcage. I just found out my sister-in-law had a kid, a baby, while I was gone, see? And I want to outfit him. The whole works. She lit up. I see. How generous of you. How sweet. What would you like in particular?
I don't know. I don't know nothing, anything, about babies.
How old is your nephew?
Huh?
Your sister-in-law's child.
Oh, gotcha. 6 months.
Isn't that dear? She twinkled professionally. What's his name?
Blaze was stumped for a moment, then he blurted, George.
Lovely name, from the Greek. It means to work the earth.
Yeah? That's pretty far out.
She kept smiling. Isn't it? Well, what does she have for him now?
Blaze was ready for this one. None of the stuff they got now is too good, that's the thing. They're really strapped for cash.
I see. So you want to start from the ground up, as it were?
Yeah, you catch.
Very generous of you. Well, the place to begin would be at the end of Pooh Avenue, in the crib corner. We have some very nice hardwood cribs. Blaze was stunned at how much it took to keep one tiny scrap of human being up and running. He had considered his take from the beer store to be quite respectable, but he left Planet Baby with a nearly flat wallet. He purchased a Dreamland crib, a Seth Harney cradle, a Happy Hippo high chair, an easy fold changing table, a plastic bath, 8 nightshirts, 8 pairs of dry day rubber pants, 8 Hager's infant undershirts with snaps he couldn't figure out, 3 fitted sheets that looked like table napkins, 3 blankets, a set of crib bumpers that was supposed to keep the kid from whamming his brains out if he got restless, a sweater, a hat, booties, a pair of red shoes with bells on the tongues, 2 pairs of pants with matching shirts, 4 pairs of socks that were not big enough to fit over his fingers, a Playtex nurser set, the plastic liners look like the bags George used to buy his dope in, a case of stuff called Similac, a case of junior fruits, a case of junior dinners, a case of junior desserts, and 1 place setting with the Smurfs on them. The baby food tasted shitty. He tried it when he got home. As the bundles piled up in the corner of the baby shop, the glances of the shy young matrons became longer and more speculative. It became an event, a landmark in memory. The huge slouching man in woodsman's clothes following the tiny sales lady from place to place, listening, then buying what she told him to buy. The sales lady was Nancy Moldau. She was on commission, and as the afternoon progressed, her eyes took on an almost supernatural glow. Finally, the total was rung up, and when Blaze counted out the money, Nancy Moldau threw in 4 boxes of Pampers. "You made my day," she said. "In fact, you may have made my career in infant sales."
"Thank you, ma'am," Blaze said.
He was very glad about the Pampers. He had forgotten the diapers after all. And as he loaded up 2 shopping carts, a stock boy had the cartons containing the high chair and the crib, Nancy Moldau cried, "Be sure to bring the young man in to have his picture taken."
"Yes, ma'am," Blaze mumbled.
For some reason, a memory of his first mugshot flashed into his mind, and a cop saying,
"Now turn sideways and bend your knees again, high pockets. Christ, who grew you so fucking big?"
"The picture is compliments of Hager's."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Lot of goodies, man," the stock boy said. He was perhaps 20 and was just getting over his adolescent acne. He wore a little red bow tie. "Where's your car parked?"
"The lot in back," Blaze said.
He followed the stock boy, who insisted on pushing one of the carts, and then complained about how it steered on the packed snow. "They don't salt it down back here, see? And the wheels get packed up. Then the damn carts skid around. You can give your ankles a nasty bite if you don't watch out. Real nasty. I'm not complaining, but..."
"Then what are you doing, sporty?"
Blaze could hear George asking.
Eating cat food out of the dog's bowl?
This is it, Blaze said. This is mine.
Yeah, okay. What do you want to put in the trunk? The high chair, the crib, or both?
Blaze suddenly remembered he didn't have a trunk key.
Let's put it all in the back.
The stock boy's eyes widened.
Ah, jeez, man. I don't think it'll fit. In fact, I'm positive we can put some in front, too. We can stand that carton with the crib in it in the passenger footwell. I'll rack the seat back.
Why not the trunk? Wouldn't that be, like, simpler?
Blaze thought vaguely of starting some story about how the trunk was full of stuff. But the trouble with lies was one always led to another. Soon it was like you were traveling on roads you didn't know. You got lost.
I always tell the truth when I can, George liked to say. It's like driving close to home.
So he held up the dupe.
I lost my car keys, he said. Until I find them, all I got is this.
Oh, the stock boy said. He looked at Blaze as though he were dumb, but that was okay. He had been looked at that way before.
Bummer.
In the end, they got it all in. It took some artful packing, and it was a tight squeeze, but they made it. When Blaze looked into the rearview mirror, he could even see some of the world outside the back window. The carton holding the broken-down changing table cut off the rest of the view.
Nice car, said the stock boy. An oldie but a goodie.
Right, Blaze said. And because it was something George sometimes said, he added,
gone from the charts, but not from our hearts.
He wondered if the stock boy was waiting for something. It seemed like he was.
What's she got, a 302?
342, Blaze said automatically. The stock boy nodded. He still stood there. From inside the back seat of the Ford, where there was no room for him but where he was anyway, somehow, George said,
if you don't want him to stand there for the rest of the century, tip the dipshit and get rid of him.
Tip, yeah, right. Blaze dragged out his wallet, looked at the limited selection of bills, and reluctantly selected a 5. He gave it to the stock boy. The stock boy made it disappear.
All right, man. Increase the piece.
Whatever, Blaze said. He got into the Ford and started it up. The stock boy was trundling the shopping carts back to the store. Halfway there, he stopped and looked back at Blaze. Blaze didn't like that look. It was a remembering look.
I should have remembered to tip him quicker, right, George?
George didn't answer. Back home, he parked the Ford in the shed again and carted all the baby crap into the house. He assembled the crib in the bedroom and set up the changing table next to it. There was no need to look at the directions. He only looked at the pictures on the boxes, and his hands did the rest. The cradle went in the kitchen, near the wood stove, but not too near. The rest of the stuff he piled in the bedroom closet, out of sight. When it was done, a change had come over the bedroom that went deeper than the added furniture. Something else had been added. The atmosphere had changed. It was as if a ghost had been set free to walk. Not the ghost of someone who had left, someone who had gone down dead, but the ghost of someone yet to come. It made Blaze feel strange.